Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Eugene Scalia representing petitioners. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The SEC has adopted a rule that it estimates will cost U.S. shareholders more than $14 billion without determinable benefits for shareholders or others. It claims this rule was required by statute, but in fact, it was obligated to observe all its statutory responsibilities and authorities, including its duty to consider its rules with an eye to their effects on efficiency and competition and capital formation, and not to impose burdens on competition that were unnecessary. Moreover, it retained its authority to provide exemptions to what Congress had ordained in the statute when it was in the public interest. In failing to properly exercise these responsibilities and authorities in three different ways, the Commission has violated the Exchange Act and once again conducted itself in a way that was arbitrary and capricious under the APA.
Is there a jurisdictional problem here?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. Section 25A provides this court jurisdiction over SEC orders, and it's now well established that where review is provided as to orders, that includes rules. The ICI case from 1977 is the seminal case.
Is that universally established, or is that true only where the statutory context suggests that it includes?
When there is at minimum ambiguity, then review is appropriate in this court. And Oxfam, which opposed jurisdiction, didn't cite a single case where there was review provided as to orders, and jurisdiction was denied. Now they do.
What about the statute?
Yes. So the question, the question becomes whether 25B changes that, and the answer is no. Remember, when the law was enacted in 1934, that term order plainly included rules, because this court's precedents make that clear. Also, remember the rule of construction that applies here. The Supreme Court said.
But wait, before we go into when Congress passed 25B, when it added it to the statute, it listed specific provisions of the statute from which rules could be appealed under 25B, right? It's unlike 25A. It was limited to certain provisions.
Yes.
And it did not include all provisions of the statute.
Your Honor, it included new provisions that were being added at the time.
But not all of them.
I believe it included all that were being added at the time.
Actually, did you check? I looked back and I mean, if that's the case, that's a useful piece of information. But I thought that they did not include them all. You think that's not right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but if I could add the following.
Yeah.
First, remember the context. The Supreme Court has said that absent a firm indication that Congress intended rules to be reviewed in district court, they will be reviewed in the Court of Appeals. 25B was a pushback to this court's mistaken decision, United Gas.
Right.
Congress was saying, we do want a Court of Appeals review. It would be backwards, we submit, to read Congress's direction that it disagreed with United Gas. It wanted review in the Court of Appeals as an indication instead that it wanted review in the district court. There are no express provisions that I'm aware of directing review of SEC rules in district courts. Remember, in Ex Portal, one of this court's decisions, the court said, when applying the Florida power and light presumption, once you get in the business of finely calibrated questions of statutory interpretation, the question's been answered in favor of jurisdiction. Again, where there's ambiguity, there's jurisdiction. We concede this could have been cleaner, it could have been clearer, but where there's ambiguity, there's jurisdiction.
Well, tell us again, where is the ambiguity? What exactly is the ambiguity in the statute?
Well, the uncertainty arises from the fact that under all the other, the two other principal securities laws administered by the SEC, orders covers rules.
But the statutes, those statutes are different.
They are different, but they're different as a result of.
No, but what's the ambiguity in 25A and B?
Well,
don't you think we have to find that to be ambiguous? Before we can apply
the ambiguity
a
resides in the fact that we know what's done with rules under those particular sections, mm-hmm. but we don't know what's done with other rules. We do know, however, that when this law was enacted in 1934, rules were included within orders, as that remains the case under the other laws. And again, we submit it would be backwards to interpret Congress's action in 1975 to indicate that it suddenly wanted all other rules reviewed in the district court, whereas under the law as it existed to that time, they belong in the Court of Appeals. That was a congressional action favoring review in the Courts of Appeals. In the ICI case, which is really the seminal case in this court on how to interpret orders to include rules, it was, again, a little bit messy. And the court said, well, the fact that the statute refers to orders and regulations, but the jurisdictional provision refers only to orders,
but again,
may
that,
have been an inadvertence.
That case didn't involve a statute that had something comparable to 25D.
But respectfully, it had a similar problem in the sense that there were separate references to rules and regulations. I'm sorry, to rules and orders, but the jurisdictional provision only talked about orders. And the court said, well, it may be an inadvertence. If I could add finally with respect to jurisdiction and then move to the merits, the Supreme Court, this court, have identified what are called sound policy reasons for appellate jurisdiction. Again, absent a firm indication that Congress intended district court jurisdiction. In addition to the other reasons identified by the court, let me emphasize the importance simply of expedition. We sought expedition of this case because of the imminent, very substantial costs affecting not just the industry but shareholders. We believe that's a reason.
Yeah, I totally share your concern about us possibly ruling that there's no jurisdiction here. That doesn't make any sense. I got you on that. But we do have to interpret this statute. I just have one more jurisdictional question to ask you. When Congress amended the Exchange Act in 1990 to add some provisions on market volatility, they actually went ahead and changed 25B also to allow the regulations under those to be challenged here. But they didn't do it this time for Dodd-Frank.
They didn't make that change.
Is there any evidence? Have you found any evidence in the legislative record of Dodd-Frank that Congress thought these appeals would come here?
In Dodd-Frank, I have not, although, as I believe the SEC will tell you, it has always been expected by practitioners and the SEC that this is the place, and the confusion results from an error committed by this court. But, Your Honor, as you said a moment ago, it doesn't make sense. Your words were something of that nature.
That's what I said.
and I think once we're in that terrain, we're in Florida Power and Light terrain, there's not a firm indication that Congress intended a different approach here than under the two other statutes the SEC administers. If I could turn then first to the Commission's exemptive authority, which is a longstanding authority the Commission has to carve out what Congress has required. Judge Brown, Judge Tatel, you each have sat on cases involving the exemptive authority, 10 different rules adopted under the Investment Company Act, where the SEC changed what Congress required in order to alleviate burden. So it's commonly used. Moreover, if you look at A65 in our brief, you'll see that Dodd-Frank actually prohibited use of the exemptive authority as to some things, but not as to this particular provision of the Act. So Congress isn't just presumed to have been aware. It was aware and left the authority open to the Commission. The reasons the Commission gave for not using the exemptive authority are the essence of arbitrary explanations. At page A8, they said an exemption wouldn't be consistent with the language of the statute. They said it wouldn't be consistent with the structure. Again, they were just talking about the extractive industries provision. With all respect, exemptions by definition are exemptions that change what Congress provided. That rationale was one the SEC successfully opposed in the Shiller case, yet here it deployed it without justification. The only
that
other
wasn't, the Commission didn't accept your claim that there were countries clearly which would have prohibited releasing this information, right? So it was operating on the assumption that, at least at the moment, there were no such countries.
Your Honor, respectfully, no. Mm-hmm. Under Chenery, they cannot now defend the rule on that ground.
Your argument is that's not what they said.
Their cost estimate, pages A48, 49, mm-hmm. said that our concerns were warranted. They said they concurred there would be potentially billions in costs. At page 35 of their own brief, they say, well, why are we being criticized for our cost-benefit analysis? We agreed with petitioners. They cannot defend this rule now by walking away from their cost-benefit analysis for the additional reason that they had an obligation under this court's precedence to do, quote, as best they can, quote. If they're now saying, well, we didn't really believe it, that becomes just another reason to vacate and remand. I want to briefly address the definition of project. They rejected a very sensible definition we proposed that is in and of itself a reason to vacate the rule. The definition of project goes very directly to the competitive harm industry members fear, which is that 90% of this market is dominated by state-owned oil companies that won't be subjected to this requirement, and they'll be able to, the more granular their information published, the better the competitive advantage they get. The SEC didn't deny that. It said that its failure to define project would reduce transparency and increase costs, but still it rejected our definition for reasons that simply don't make sense. In page 31 of our reply, we put together just a little chart showing it was eminently possible to define project as we had proposed. And again, it's indisputed, if you look at pages 4253, that's A4253, that they would have saved cost, further transparency, whereas elsewhere in this adopting release, they said, we can't do things that won't, we must do things that will further transparency, yet here they refuse to do so. Finally, with respect to requiring public disclosure, we believe the only acceptable interpretation of the statute was that filings could be confidential, but at minimum, there was room for discretion here. The statute was ambiguous. When you look at the text, when you look at the title, which says the public availability results from SEC compilation, when you look at the conflict minerals provision, a neighboring provision of the same statute makes companies explicitly file publicly. And then you get so much reliance from the Commission on legislative history, yet you have Senator Cardin coming to the floor saying, we've made changes from prior bills, changes which we've explained in our reply brief and our opening brief. We've made changes to give utmost flexibility to avoid burdening companies. But time and again, the Commission declined to exercise that discretion. Finally,
I'll just ask you one question about cost-benefit analysis, generally, not with respect to the exemption issue, but you rely very heavily on Business Roundtable. The Commission says this case is different because here you have a command by Congress to issue these regulations. So in a sense, they argue Congress has already made at least the benefit side of the analysis.
Your Honor, that's wrong for a couple of reasons. Uh-huh. First of all, any reasonably informed rulemaking where there's a statutory duty to do a cost-benefit analysis looks at where the costs fall and the benefits fall.
So do you think Congress could have, do you think the Commission could have concluded that this was not, that the cost-benefit analysis weighed against it and not issued the regulations? Notwithstanding?
No, they
couldn't do that.
They needed
right?
to do a regulation, but Your Honor, they right. should have looked, for example, at China. You read their brief. They say this is about poor countries, heavily dependent on oil revenue, unstable governments, risk of overthrow of the government, and terrorism. Does that describe China?
No.
Does it describe Qatar?
So you weren't saying, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Your point is that the cost-benefit analysis was related to how the regulation was written and its scope, right? Not to whether they could issue it at all.
Remember, they had an exemptive authority, but we're not here to argue that they could have used
Am
it to
right
exempt themselves from doing any rule. But here, they should have focused where the costs were and examined whether
benefits. Focus in on the question.
Okay,
and see if you could answer that you're not saying it has to do with whether they would have a regulation. It is how the regulation is applied, or
it's how it's written, and so specifically with respect to the exemptive authority, for example, when they saw that the lion's share of costs, that $12.5 billion was focused on four countries, they should have said, "Wow, what are the benefits of covering those four countries?"
But again,
countries?
It wasn't convinced that those countries, in fact, prohibited.
Your Honor,
disclosure
they
documents.
Can't go there under Chenery. Moreover, if they're here to tell you that they did a bad cost-benefit analysis, that becomes yet again a reason to vacate their rule. Finally, with respect to the First Amendment, this Court must reach it if it otherwise affirms this rule. This is an exceptional statute that commandeers corporate speech to force regime change in other nations. They've not cited another regulation or statute that's ever been like this. Moreover, strict scrutiny applies except in narrow circumstances. This is not commercial speech. They concede that. I'd like to reserve the
remainder. What about, just real quickly on the First Amendment, I know the Commission doesn't cite it, but you do. What about our decision in full value advisors? Doesn't that, what's the impact of that on your argument that there's a First Amendment issue with respect to the disclosure to the Commission?
I understand
the question.
Right. Yeah. Your Honor, the Court there drew a very clear distinction between information submitted to the agency for use by the agency. They've told you, we don't really use this information. Uh-huh. We just hand it over to the public. So it's a very different circumstance.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
William Shirey for the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Can you help us on jurisdiction?
Yes. We don't have a great deal to add beyond what petitioners have identified. we would emphasize that this is one of the rare situations where, although it may appear on the face of the statute that the text is clear, this is one of those rare situations where resort to the statutory history and the legislative history is necessary, I think, to indicate that what may appear facially clear is in fact ambiguous.
And how does the legislative history help you? I had the impression that it actually made it harder for you here. Why don't you explain that?
Sure. I think my emphasis would be on the statutory history, which is that at the time that the Congress in 1975 added 25B, and it did so as part of the National Markets Reform Act, Congress was of the view, based on this court's interpretation of the word order, that orders did not encompass rules, and therefore that the 25A did not apply to rules. The court subsequently changed its view, and I think clarified its view in Investment Company Institute, and that ultimately that change should in no way be 25B should in no way be read into sort of somehow preventing the change from the court from viewing order as having that more robust meaning here as well.
I don't understand your point. Well, let me ask you this: did when Congress let me just ask you to say something about the discussion I was having with Mr. Scalia about what happened in 1975? Were the provisions that Congress included in 25B all of the newly added provisions to the Exchange Act, or were there others that were not included? Do you know?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't know off the top of my head.
And what's your reaction to the consequences of what happened in 1990 when Congress added a new provision to the Exchange Act, namely the one dealing with market volatility, and then amended 25B to permit rules issued under that to be challenged here, but that it didn't do that with Dodd-Frank? What do we do with that?
On the first issue of the 1990 changes, the legislative history is sort of silent as to why.
I was talking about the statute.
Right.
The statute, you agree, they amended 25B to permit appeals here for market volatility regulations, right?
Right, correct.
Okay, and they didn't do it for Dodd-Frank.
So when we're
trying to figure out what this statute means, when we're all searching for ambiguity, right?
Right.
Okay, doesn't that make finding ambiguity extremely difficult?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Tell
because
me why.
Remember, 20 years had passed in the interceding period, so I think it's sort of hard to attribute what the Congress did in 1990, particularly given that the legislative history is, even in the 1990, is sort of silent and only refers to this as a conforming amendment in 1990. So I think it's hard to impute anything to the Dodd-Frank Congress.
Well, it's not a matter of imputation. It's a matter of what does the statute say or do. This notion that we have to read the mind of Congress is a bit alien. The fact that it's 20 years apart, I'm not sure why that has any significance. It all goes into the same statute, and we have to construe that statute.
Your Honor, I think the best answer is by the time that the Dodd-Frank Congress acted in 2010, as Mr. Scalia pointed out, there had just been a well-established practice under the Exchange Act. Everyone understood. The expectation was that orders really do encompass rules, and you know, by that point, remember, this court had handed down three different decisions in the securities law arena. Now, all of those, admittedly, were not under the Exchange Act, but it was sort of generally understood, I think, by the people who were thinking about Dodd-Frank that, of course, commission rules go to the Court of Appeals.
Is there anything in the legislative history of Dodd-Frank that indicates that's what Congress thought? In other words, that it knew it was legislating in an environment where these challenges would come here?
I am not aware of anything in the legislative history
find anything either. So.
Because as you know, Congress made no changes to the jurisdictional provisions in Dodd-Frank with respect to Section 25.
And what's your reaction to the Oxfam argument that under your interpretation, 25B becomes superfluous?
We don't think that's correct, Your Honor.
But why?
Principally because, as this court has talked about in its ripeness jurisprudence, when Congress specifically identifies a provision as going to the Court of Appeals, which it certainly has done in 25B, there's a heavier presumption that attaches against a finding of ripeness in that instance. So there is still some value to 25B. And remember, 25B dealt with critically important changes in 1975 that were designed to really create a national market system. So it was particularly imperative that there be no finding of lack of ripeness in those cases. Turning to the merits of the challenge here, Your Honor, I think you put it exactly correctly, or you sort of hit the nail on the head, Judge Tatel, earlier when you sort of identified the fact that this was Congress. This is really, at the end of the day, a congressional rulemaking. It's a congressionally mandated rulemaking. Congress spoke to the principal issues, whether it's the publication of the information that comes into the commission, that it ultimately should be going out to the public in the same format, foreclosing this possibility of some kind of anonymized aggregation that neither the legislative history or, more importantly, the statute doesn't speak to. Just taking the publication issue for a second, you have very issuer-specific information that's coming in. You have the projects that has to come in, that has to be identified. You have the business unit of the company that comes in. The only use for that information is to be provided to the public. So the idea that somehow Congress left on the table the possibility of an anonymized aggregation when the entire purpose of this statute is to provide transparency.
But you're looking at statutory language here. And as I understand it, the commission's view is that this statute, that the use of the word compilation is unambiguous, correct?
The commission did not say either way whether the use of the word compilation.
Well, you're taking that position, correct? Aren't you?
I think the commission's
position was that this statute, the use of the word compilation and the fact that the statute's a disclosure statute, required the commission to issue, release everything and not to do a compilation and deletion of other materials, right? That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
That it's unambiguous.
With respect to the argument, it's unambiguous with respect to the view that the petitioners have advanced, which is that compilations somehow could be read to include an anonymized aggregation. That view is outside of, is not a reasonable interpretation of compilation.
Well, but the statute says, to the extent practical, what role in the language, what role in the statute does that language play?
Well, Your Honor, as the commission explained in the adopting release, it's the commission's view and that the statute requires, not that actually compilation is subject to a practicability determination, that it may actually prove impracticable to do the compilation for some reason or another, but that at the end of the day, this is a provision that was added, Section 13Q was a provision that was added to the Exchange Act. The Exchange Act is all about one of the principal purposes of the Exchange Act is that annual reports, current reports, quarterly reports, that those reports are made public.
Right, but when the Exchange Act requires that elsewhere, it actually says that. It says disclosure. And this statute says, this provision of it says, to the extent practical, it should do a compilation. I understand your argument that compilation could certainly include, you could interpret it to include, you might be able to interpret it to support what the commission has done, but what I'm asking you about is what in this language makes this unambiguous? That's what I'm having trouble with.
Your Honor, this court and the Supreme Court have instructed that one of the ways, when you're at Chevron 1, that you determine whether a statute is unambiguous is you look at the structure and the design of the statute. And here you have a statutory provision that provides no use for the information that comes in other than providing that information to the public. There is no independent use that the commission's identified with to do with this.
Right, but compiling it and reordering it and maybe deleting some materials is not inconsistent with that.
Your Honor, it is, if I may explain. There's really two legs that 13Q stands on, and it's identified in Section 13Q2. There's the project-level disclosures and the government-level disclosures, okay? And what the statute is designed to do is it's to provide transparency on both both ends, what resources are generating the funds and where those funds are ultimately going to the government. If you were accepting petitioner's argument about an anonymized aggregation only gives you the second piece of that, because their whole view is that you can just sort of anonymize the payments that are paid to the government. But you lose that first critical piece of the transparency here. That's the project level disclosures. And projects, by definition, can't be aggregated. You can't aggregate the ExxonMobil project with the Shell project that maybe sits on the other side of a, take Turkmenistan, for instance. Turkmenistan sits on one geological zone, okay? You can't in any meaningful way determine where the resources, the payments are coming from ultimately, what resource extraction activity the payments are coming from in that sense. You really can't anonymize or aggregate that information to provide the transparency benefit.
What about the petitioner's argument that when you compare this language to the conflict minerals section, which says each person described in paragraph 2 shall make available to the public on the internet website the information disclosed. See, there it says they shall make available the information disclosed, whereas here it says the commission shall release a compilation to the extent practical.
Your Honor, I actually believe that section 13P proves our case. Uh-huh. The commission's view is that annual reports are released to the public. Those are released to the public for investors. But both 13Q and 13P, Congress identified, are not just for investors. They are for investors according to Congress, but they're also for non-investors. In the case of 13P, it's individuals who are consumers. Where are consumers going to, unlike investors who are used to going through our EDGAR database on an issuer-by-issuer basis and looking at annual reports, that's not the case with consumers. So consumers are going to go and look on the web page. The same holds true the same is true of the compilation. The compilation is the supplementary disclosure mechanism for non-investors, for the folks who are, for instance, in Nigeria or in Afghanistan, who are looking to see how the looking to see what the transparency payment transparency disclosures are for their particular country. So it's just a different target audience, but both are important to the disclosures here. If I may turn to the benefits here.
Turn to the constitutional question.
Certainly, Your Honor. Simply put, the information that's required to be disclosed here is not speech for purposes of the First Amendment.
Why not?
It's simply factual data that does not touch upon.
Factual data can't be speech?
Factual data in certain instances could be,
well,
but
do you
not
have any
in
any authority for the proposition that the First Amendment cannot protect factual data.
The First Amendment does not. There is no proposition for that, Your Honor.
Right.
But there's also no proposition that it does, and that's critical. For years, it has been understood and taken that information that's required to be disclosed to the government that's objective, non-ideological, factual information, such as this, that doesn't either otherwise communicate a view or require a person to express belief, that doesn't otherwise isn't required to be communicated in an inextricably or in an intertwined manner with other protected speech, and that doesn't somehow dampen or chill other values of the First Amendment, like associational speech, that has never been subjected to First Amendment scrutiny, and we submit that that's the case.
Well, what is your best authority that that's not subjected to First Amendment scrutiny?
Your Honor, we don't have any direct authority on point for that, but we also don't have any authority that it is. But more important,
shouldn't we start out with the proposition that speech his speech and protected unless we have some reason for exempting it. The First Amendment reads, I realize that it's not popular to be absolutist on First Amendment, but it reads pretty absolutely. So shouldn't we start there, and then you have the, if you're going to regulate it, you have to back away.
Two things, Your Honor. First of all, again, this type of factual data that the government requires in myriad regulatory programs, it just doesn't touch upon the core values that the First Amendment, that the founders established the First Amendment for. But even if one were to suppose that this nonetheless somehow were subjected to some type of First Amendment scrutiny, it's critical to recognize that rational basis review would be the most that's necessary. Take for instance, Zouderer. To be sure, that was in the commercial speech context. But there, you actually have, notwithstanding the fact that it was factual objective disclosure, you actually have a greater First Amendment intrusion, arguably, because the speech there was required to be made in the context of other fully protected speech, commercial speech. You don't have any of that here. So it would be illogical to, even supposing that one were to treat this as speech, to impose anything other than...
I don't get that even if one were to suppose. Sorry. This is speech. You got the duty to back out of it. I mean, it's pretty well established the speaker has a right to tailor their speech. And I don't know that...
Well, you're,
in fact, I think Hurley says it applies not only to views or opinions, but the right of the speaker to tailor their speech.
Your Honor, even if one were to treat this as speech, we still submit that rational base, the Zouder,
I really don't get that lead-in, even if this were to treat this as speech. All right, if one treats this speech as speech, what now is your government interest in regulating it, which may back you into the benefit you wanted to talk about a while ago? But.
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, this the disclosures here are part of a broader package of foreign policy programs that have long been established to provide transparency to resource-rich countries, for payments in resource-rich countries. And this is just another piece of that.
I didn't get a real clear answer to what the governmental interest is that's protected by,
again,
served by this intrusion on free speech.
It's a First Amendment, or it's a foreign policy objective to promote transparency in resource-rich countries, Your Honor.
The closest parallel saying that is a sufficient interest to regulate speech?
Two things, Your Honor. First, this court's recent decision, I believe in 2009 with National Manufacturers Association, where this court talked in the domestic arena, to be sure, talked about transparency being important to help promote accountability, political accountability. As Congress has long identified in the context of dealing with the resource curse, it is very important to U.S. foreign policy to have established democratic, legitimate governments that don't, for instance, breed terrorism, that allow for stable political alliances.
I see the connection between this and terrorism.
The legislative history does discuss this. I believe the 2008 minority report identifies that. But
how
in
does
any
it advance the war against terrorism to compel this disclosure?
Your Honor, I believe it's a long, it's a long-term answer in the sense that if you have failed governments, ultimately breed political resistance within the country that ultimately leads to
dictatorship. But how does that breed terrorism? There have been dictatorships throughout history and prehistory that have not been terrorists.
Your Honor, at the end of the day, I believe this is an area that is ripe for deference to Congress. That's what the Supreme Court discussed in...
No. Governmental interest on First Amendment regulation is not something where we defer to Congress.
Actually, Your Honor, I believe in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, the Supreme Court talked about deference in the foreign policy arena, and also in this court's decision in National Manufacturing Association versus, the last name is slipped me right now, but it's the 2009 decision that Judge Garland wrote. There as well, this court talked about deference to the common sense value judgments that Congress makes.
But you have to first identify the interest.
And the interest is I believe, very clearly identified in the legislation itself, which is promoting the federal government's foreign policy objective to promote payment transparency.
I thought your strongest defense wasn't that, but that it was that this is designed to provide information to American investors. Isn't that, I mean, do you really want to argue quite as strongly as you are about national security, given your emphasis that this statute is really most defensible on the grounds of providing disclosure to American investors?
Your Honor, Congress certainly believed that this information was important to investors. For that reason, Congress obviously put it in the Exchange Act. That stands to reason. And that also provides a second basis for supporting the disclosures here, because it is well established that disclosures to investors do not trigger some kind of heightened First Amendment scrutiny as a general matter. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one more minute. I cut you off. Was there something else you wanted to say on benefits? Is that okay? We ask you.
Certainly. This is a situation, it's important to distinguish this from, for instance, the Proxy Access Decision Business Roundtable, or even the other cases that this court has heard that the petitioner identifies dealing with the benefit analysis. This is a statutory provision that Congress has mandated, first of all, and it's mandated in virtually an unprecedented fashion within the securities laws. If you look, they have very carefully spelled out not only what's to be disclosed, whether it's the issuer's project from which the payments came, whether it's the business.
You quickly move to what the benefit is that I cut you off on.
Sorry. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the benefit is to provide payment transparency and also to provide information to investors.
Payment transparency sounds kind of circular. Why are you compelling this payment transparency? Because it promotes payment transparency.
Congress has made the determination in the foreign policy arena that will help promote the ultimate goal of.
Sorry, I've prolonged it.
Sorry.
Thanks.
So, what's the role then, in your mind, of the cost benefit analysis? Congress did require, but what's the role of the cost-benefit analysis then?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I know that cost-benefit is sort of a nice formulation to use, but the Commission's obligation here is slightly more specific. The Commission's obligation here is to consider the rule's impact on efficiency, competition, and capital formation. And as this Court has instructed, that requires the Commission to consider as best it can what the economic implications of the rule are. And here, the Commission did that, ultimately deferring to Congress's determination about the benefits, because the benefits were difficult to quantify or determine with any precision. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the Commission did use the cost analysis and the competitive effects to, throughout the rulemaking, tailor provisions, not the ones that petitioners are complaining about, but other provisions, such as limiting not expanding beyond the statute's contours of the definition of commercial development, taking a very reasonable approach to the definition of de minimis, not requiring accounting, any kind of auditing of the disclosures here. So the cost-benefit analysis did play a role, Your Honor. It played a role in the discretionary components of this rulemaking, which petitioners, unfortunately, have identified areas that really weren't up to discretion, at least two of those areas, publication and the exemption. Okay. Are there any more questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
How much time did Mr. Scalia have? Mr. Scalia, you can take a couple of minutes, and I won't even include your answer to this question in those couple of minutes.
Don't start yet.
I have one more jurisdictional question for you. You make an effort I think it's in your brief, in a footnote in your brief, to make a valiant effort to suggest that 25B would not be superfluous, right? That is in your brief, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
We refer to Overton Park.
Yeah, and so as I understand it, your argument is that 25B would still operate to bring to the appeals court challenges to rules where there's an Overton Park issue, right?
It would, Your Honor. And if I could emphasize, this court seeks to avoid treating statutory language as superfluous or redundant because it's trying to get at congressional intent.
Right.
Congress does not consciously enact language that achieves nothing, and that's not what it did in 1975. It enacted language to correct.
Let's go back to my question about superfluous 25B. If we're looking for an explanation for why a particular provision is not superfluous, doesn't it have to be something that there's some evidence that Congress intended? In other words, to put it in the context of this case, is there any indication at all that what Congress intended with 25B here was to bring cases, ensure that cases here with Overton Park-type issues got to the Court of Appeals?
Well, Your Honor, I think what's let me answer that, but then there's something I think is more important. Yes, there is indication that it continues to have effect. If you look at 25A5, which has to do with orders, there's a provision that if more evidence is relevant, go back to the agency. No such provision appears in 25B, which is consistent with our Overton Park explanation. But more importantly, Your Honor, the question of congressional intent is applied at the time of enactment, and we know Congress was seeking to correct this court's error in United Gas, at least as to these new authorities. And with all respect, it would seem backwards for this court now to, because Congress was acting against an error of this court, for this court to, in a sense, reinstate within this realm the error of United Gas, because Congress, when it enacted the 34 Act, did make rules reviewable as orders. This court's decision created confusion that Congress was trying in part to address. Congress can proceed in stages, and I think, you know, that's what you have here. Finally, you did also ask, Your Honor, about the 1990 Act.
Right.
That was a provision that also had to do with the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, and the market volatility concern there bore some relationship to the concern of the 75 amendments, which I think I believe gives you some further explanation. I concede it's ambiguous. This
court what's the explanation? But they did amend 25B. Right?
That's right. And they were adding a provision
that
had to do with market volatility, which bore some relationship to the provisions that had been added in 1975. So it made sense to treat them like the others. I certainly agree with Mr. Shirey, but that by the time of Dodd-Frank, it was widely understood that rules could be reviewed as orders. And again, it's only this court's erroneous decision in United Gas that created the confusion that we're trying to address now. Have you had enough of jurisdiction, Your Honor?
One more question about the superfluous thing, and then you can have your 2 minutes on the merits. If let's assume you're right that about Overton Park, wouldn't we, if we were being consistent in terms of our interpretation of the statute, since we interpreted order to mean rule, if there was, you know, if there was no district court fact finding required, wouldn't we do the same thing about rule and say that, look, just doesn't make sense to have this court here in Overton Park type case, and so we're going to interpret rule to mean, you know, anything that doesn't require district court fact finding. So those cases would go to the district court, which would leave 25B superfluous.
But I don't think that 25B contemplates that.
Of course it doesn't.
Because
that's
it's directly
my whole
in this
point.
Court.
Of course it doesn't. You just made my point.
But
it doesn't contemplate it either way, right?
25B contemplates, it hardwires review in this court. 25A leaves it subject to the caveat that does exist for Overton Park.
You can go ahead on the merits.
With respect to the First Amendment, Judge Tatel, you asked about full value. The court there said what was important is that the commission, not the public, is the only audience. Effectively here, the only audience is the public. Judge Brown, you authored that decision. The other point the court made with respect to Zouderer was that Zouderer had never been applied outside the context of correcting deceptive speech. Zouderer has no application here whatsoever. Finally, with respect to this purported fact opinion distinction, in the Riley case, Justice Brennan, writing for the court, said that Tornillo and Woolley, the leading compelled speech cases, cannot be distinguished simply because they involve compelled statements of opinion, while here we deal with compelled statements of fact. That's page 797 to 98 of Riley. The First Amendment issue here, among other things, should function as a principle of constitutional avoidance to in construing what was required to be made public. Mr. Shirey has referred to the conflict minerals provision, but remember, that required publication on the website, something that was absent here. We've also shown the changes that Congress made to avoid a direct requirement to publish by the company. With respect to cost-benefit analysis, with all respect, it was remarkable for me to hear Mr. Shirey have to be asked finally to address the cost of this rule. This is the agency assigned to protect shareholders. It adopted a rule minimum, $14 billion costs on U.S. shareholders to the competitive advantage of foreign countries, and you saw how little concern the Commission held with regard to that, even at this argument today. There were numerous ways beyond the small ministerial changes that were identified to you by which Congress could have, the Commission could have vastly reduced the costs here, including, for example, grandfathering countries that currently prohibited these kinds of disclosures. For all of these reasons, we respectfully submit this rule should be vacated. And again, we urge the Court that we have sought expedition, and we believe that's a reason that jurisdiction belongs here, but at minimum, we believe it's a reason that it would be valuable to all concerned for the Court to address this as its schedule permits.
Gentlemen, thank you. The case is submitted. The Court will take a brief recess.